Good morning. I'm Christopher Purdy. Delighted to welcome you all to today's edition of All Sides Weekend. This is our arts and culture segment, which I'd like to say is also what's going on around town. What do you need to know about? And I have three people with lots of great information, three people who are really representing arts and culture in our community brilliantly. And they are Peter Stafford Wilson, who I'm trying to count now, is the music director and conductor. I'll tell you what I know of the Springfield Symphony Orchestra, the Westerville Symphony Orchestra. In his spare time, he gets on a plane and goes to Tulsa, Oklahoma, where he's the music director of the Tulsa Ballet. How you conduct ballet, I will never understand, but God bless you. And you said there's one more.
Yeah, actually, I've added the title of principal guest conductor for the Kansas City Ballet. So
you must love the ballet.
I love it.
We'll talk there. Peter Stafford Wilson is here. He has a very special concert to tell us about that's going to be a week from yesterday, next Thursday
exactly.
night. We'll talk more. Professor Arvid Ashby is here. Arvid Ashby is Professor Emeritus of Music at The Ohio State University. He has written a new book, not his first, very far from his first. He is the biographer of Gustav Mahler. He has taught many a course in the School of Music at The Ohio State University, including seminars that included works of Frank Zappa. So he is a guy you really need to know better. Arvid Ashby's brand new book is called My 1980s Gay Boy Playlist, and we'll talk about that as our conversation ensues. And the adult in the room, and we're all going to try to behave and make a good impression, is Brooke Minto. Brooke Minto is the executive director of the Columbus Museum of Art, and the last time you were invited, you couldn't come because you had a cold.
There you go.
So you're here now, and I'm delighted.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's
welcome
wonderful
you,
to be back.
Brooke Minto here. I want you to get a little closer to the microphone. That's good.
How's
about
that?
About a fist ways away. Y'all might want to write this down out there in listening land. Tell me, Brooke Minto, this is, I think, your third year as executive director of the museum?
Yeah, it was 3 years in May.
3 years in May. So this is that gorgeous building on Broad Street. People drive by it all the time. Let's get them to stop the car. Get out of the car and go into the museum.
Absolutely.
What's going on at the museum right now? If I stopped my car today and went in the parking lot, what would I be experiencing?
Well, the museum is feeling more accessible than ever these days, Chris. And I think if you stopped and walked in today, what you would hear is that we are now free for everyone 25 and under. And this is a really spectacular initiative that started this month, July 1st. As the result of a very transformational gift from the Walter Foundation. So for the next 5 years, 25 and under, all visitors are free every day that we're open. And for young ones, 16 and under, they are also free with a caregiver. So this is a really wonderful, wonderful change at the museum, one that kicks off a larger initiative called Access 150, where we're really thinking about how we open up our doors to as many locals and visitors alike who are in the Columbus region.
The gift you just referenced that made this possible, is this the kind of a gift that you in your capacity pursued because you wanted young people to be able to make a home there?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, we believe strongly that removing financial barriers is the way to get as many people into the museum as possible and as young as we can so that the museum becomes an essential part of their lives very early on. So we're, you know, still raising more support for this initiative, but we have a very fantastic lead gift and one that we're incredibly grateful for and that we know will encourage others to contribute to this initiative over the next several years.
The Columbus Museum of Art, I hope everybody remembers that, is now free to persons under 25 years, under 16, with a caregiver.
With an accompaniment, yes. And we remain free on Sundays for families, so everyone on Sundays. That's a program that started a number of years ago that really
right.
initiated this larger project. So on Sundays, the whole family is free.
When did this begin, the under 25?
July 1st. So
really?
We're 3 weeks in, and we're already seeing
what
tremendous
have you noticed?
Results.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Oh, I mean, younger people throughout the week. So because we've been free on Sundays, families typically arrived on Sundays with, you know, little ones, with grandparents. But now we see families, especially because it's summer, coming on weekdays. We've noticed that all of our drop-in programs, our open studios and art-making programs for kids, teens, and adults, all of those programs are at full tilt. You know, we're as highly subscribed as we can be.
60 years ago, when I was in grammar school, which we used to call it, like third or fourth grade, we took field trips to the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and you stayed in line, and you didn't move, and you didn't touch anything, and you had all kinds of older adults glaring at you. Discuss. Mm-hmm. How is it now?
Totally different. Okay. You know, our Center for Creativity really encourages engagement, hands-on art making, and so it's really at the crux of all of the programming that we offer there. There's interactive projects for learners of all ages. There's pre-scheduled programming that you register for, but then there's also drop-in programming. And, you know, unlike those days, we also have things like CMA Next, our new Teen Arts Council, where a dozen high school students come together and curate their own programming. So over the course of several weeks, they learn about careers in art museums, and we teach them about contemporary art and what it's like, you know, having an art practice of your own. And then they curate their own programming for other teens.
That's very interesting. That's wonderful when you just said you're helping people look at career possibilities in museums, museum management, curators, et cetera. So mm-hmm. we're going to come back and talk more about the Center of Creative Programming, because I was around when that opened, and that was a big deal, and I'm glad that it's still thriving. Brooke Minto is the Executive Director of the Columbus Museum of Art. This is All Sides Weekend on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Christopher Purdy, and Arvid Ashby, full disclosure, he and Peter Stafford Wilson are old friends of mine. Arvid Ashby's new book, My 1980s Gay Boy Playlist, I'm going to read a couple of sentences from the press release, and then we're going to talk about it. Award-winning music writer Arvid Ashby, which we knew, muses over pieces that impacted his sexual and musical awakening as a troubled gay adolescent. Pieces by Tchaikovsky, Chopin, Beethoven, Bruckner, Prince, Kurt Cobain, Al Bunberg, and Tom Petty. That is quite a lineup. You were a very precocious child, weren't you?
Oh, yes, with a large record collection that terrorized my poor parents with continually. Yeah, my musical tastes, and this gets to the gist of the matter, have always been strange and kind of everywhere at once. And I've, as long as I can remember, loved music that other people couldn't stand, and wasn't crazy about music that I was supposed to like. And it was all kind of a very interesting dislocation. So this book gets into that. It's funny, I was just thinking, this is not in the book, but I was thinking the other day, do you know what the very first record I ever bought?
I was going to ask you. What?
I remember this. Are you ready for this? It was Alice Cooper's Welcome to My Nightmare. I bought it.
How old were you?
Oh, God, I must have been maybe 10 or something.
Wow.
I got it at the local Sears. This is when Sears sold LPs. I remember going in with lots of nickels and dimes and plunking this pile of nickels and dimes down and getting Alice Cooper's Welcome to My Nightmare in return. So I've not really listened to Alice much lately, but that's kind of the theme in play here. Lots of variety and things hither and yon.
Why do you think when you were a young child you were, for lack of a better term, bitten by a musical bug like that?
I think I've always, well, I think the term I tend to go towards is music dependency. I actually use a term, music dependency, which makes it sound a little like drug dependency, I suppose. But it's true. I thinking back, I think just growing up and being lonely and just having so much going on in my head that if it weren't for music of a huge variety of kinds, getting deeply into examples of music over the years, that I wouldn't be here today. I can just put it in that fashion.
You and I have had parallel lives. I'm a little bit older than that, but I'm not writing a book. You are. So it's your story that is germane to this discussion. Arvid Ashby's new book is My 1980s Gay Boy Playlist, and we're going to talk more as the show goes on. With specific examples of music that really moved you as a young kid and how that really threw into your upbringing and your identification as a young gay man. Peter Stafford Wilson is also here. He's music. I forgot the list. Springfield Symphony, Westerville, Kansas City Ballet, and Tulsa Ballet. But you still live here. The Springfield Symphony, of which you have been music director for a number of years, plays in a gorgeous state-of-the-art facility at the Clark State Performing Arts Center in Springfield. I need to talk to you about Springfield, but let's get specific about July 30th. What's happening then?
We've got an exciting concert coming up with Joshua Bell, one of the greatest violinists on the planet right now. Thursday night, July 30th, he's playing the Brooks Scottish Fantasy with us on a concert that just kind of morphed out of nothing. I had been looking at Joshua for our subscription series. You know, we had a great success with Itzhak Perlman a few years ago, and just a stunning evening and a sold-out house. And so I called his management, Primo Artis, and the owner, director of the firm is an old dear friend of mine, Charlotte Lee. And rather than getting a call back from the sales agent telling me that, no, Mr. Bell is not available or Mr. Bell costs X $100,000, Charlotte called me and she said, you know, Joshua's got a performance of the Scottish Fantasy this summer with the Boston Symphony at Tanglewood. And as you know, they're getting a little extra notoriety these days.
That's another show. Which, boy, that's two or three shows.
Oh,
yes.
It is. Yeah. It is. But at any rate, he wanted a warm-up. And she said, I know that this season is already set. I know you've already, you know, budgeted everything. But could you put something together? And so I went back to the board, and she added some very glowing things that Mr. Perlman had said about his experience with us. So I went to the board, and basically the answer was, well, we can't not do this, right. Which yeah. I guess was kind of backhanded, but I took it, and went out and raised the money, and sure enough, we put it together for this summer season, which is unique for us. So we'll see how it works out. There's still inventory, but it's only a 45-minute drive from the greater Columbus area, and free parking. Chris, have you ever heard about
that? There's a wonderful... I've been there many times, and I have to tell you, it's well worth the trip. The trip is not a big deal if you live in a campus or a central, you know, downtown Columbus area. It's right. Really not a big deal at all. And it's still daylight, so you're not driving in the dark if you don't
exactly.
know where it is.
And it's a shorter program, so you'll be out by 8:30, 9 o'clock, you know. And you'll be amazed at the quality. You know, we live in a very fertile area where music talent is concerned because there's so many great music schools. It's as you say, well worth the trip.
The Springfield Symphony, how many years now have you been music director there?
We're going to celebrate my 25th season
really?
After next, yeah.
And how the orchestra has been around for many years in Springfield. That surprised some people, but it's
right.
yeah, it's been there
it's
a long time.
It's pushing on 70.
Really?
You know, I love to tell the story of the fact that the Springfield Symphony was born in 1943. Mm. Think about what was going on in our
yeah.
country. And the astonishing thing, when I look at the program from that open, I mean, there was Haydn, there was Schubert, there were German composers.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, we needed something to come together as community, which you and I have talked about, Chris, many, many times.
Many times.
Think
right?
about 9/11 when you know, the sports ceased, but the concerts went on.
Yeah. Peter Stafford Wilson conducts the Springfield Symphony all season long, which we'll talk about, but specifically right. next Thursday night, July 30th, at the Clark State Performing Arts Center with violinist Joshua Bell playing Max Brooks' Scottish Fantasy. Tickets how?
Through the Clark State box office.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, I don't have
That's
their number.
Just Google it. It's
yeah.
all there.
Or go on our website, springfieldsym.org. It'll link you right to the box office. And there is significant inventory. Good seats are still available.
Well, let's make sure, like, in 40 minutes they're not. Anyway,
good.
We are going to take a quick break and come back with more All Sides Weekend. Don't go away.
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.
We are back. This is All Sides Weekend. I'm Christopher Purdy. My guests are Dr. Arvid Ashby, Professor Emeritus of Music at The Ohio State University. His new book is My 1980s Gay Boy Playlist. Peter Stafford Wilson is the music director for this conversation of the Springfield Symphony. You might want to write them down. There's more coming. And Brooke Minto is the executive director of the Columbus Museum of Art. What is the Center for Creative?
Center for Creativity.
Creativity. Talk to me about that at the museum.
It's really the hub of learning engagement at the museum. So when you come into the museum, it's on the ground floor. And for the last, I'd say, 12, if not 15 years, the 18,000 square foot space has had various kinds of activations and galleries for interactive learning.
So hands-on, you can touch things.
Yeah. We have an open studio that every Saturday, young ones of all ages can come in and do art making. Every first Saturday of the month, that is reserved for members of the museum, but it's every Saturday. There's also teen studios that have engaging art making activities for older learners. But really, it's one of the most energetic areas of the museum. The heart of it is the Wonder Room, which is a really kind of hands-on, interactive play space. We have Baby and Me tours in that space and all kinds of other family adventures. So it really is like this little engine that hums about in the middle of the museum.
Tell me about do you have a big exhibition now of Asian art? Can you talk about that for us?
Yeah, it opened in April. So if you haven't seen it yet, you've got to get there. It's on its final weeks right now. It's called East of the Pacific. And the exhibition came to us from partners on the West Coast at the Kanner Art Center. It's the campus art museum at Stanford University. And most of the exhibition is drawn from their collection, but it's also complemented by about a dozen works from our permanent collection of the museum, some more historical, and then the majority of which are contemporary arts that were recently gifted from the Scantlin family.
Now, you're in your third year as the executive director of the museum. I'm curious to know about where you came from and what brought you to Columbus.
All good questions. Yeah, third year. I moved from New York to Columbus, and I think we've talked about that. I'm originally from there and grew up there, but I've lived in different places for museums. I was in South Florida at a museum in Miami for 7 years. Then I lived in the Gulf Coast in Louisiana for a number of years and was at a museum there. But most recently was back in New York, and that's where I moved to Columbus from.
Brooke Minto was the executive director. What does the executive director do? Do you walk the galleries? Do you have time to walk the galleries when people are there?
I do. And when we have visitors more often, I also get the privilege of going after hours when we're closed. So that's like a lot of fun to be in the museum after hours. But, my first couple of years, I spent a lot of time recruiting. So, we've really grown our team at the museum. As of, I would say, 6 months ago, we have a full curatorial complement again, curators of American art, photography, contemporary art, European art. So that took some time to do that recruiting and to bring some new talent to town, all of whom are getting settled and nested in Columbus, which is really exciting. And they're, thinking about the artistic program of the museum for years to come. What are the collection goals and strategies, and what are we going to show everybody?
What part of the permanent collection do you personally love?
That's a hard question.
I know.
So I'll say my area of expertise is really post-war and contemporary art. So art from, I'd say, 1945 to the present. And I'm really excited about the ways in which the collection has been growing in that area. So in terms of acquisitions, that's what I enjoy. But I think the real gift of CMA is that we can think about all of those acquisitions and contemporary art exhibitions in the context of a very, very strong historical permanent collection. So they're just really great historical works like our Artemisia Gentileschi painting that was the feature of a recent exhibition in partnership with the Getty. We also just have wonderful works of American art, of photography, along with European painting, like the French paintings from the Sirac collection that's much beloved. So there's a whole range of things.
Well, and again, I want to make the point, repeat about the under 25s.
So as of July 1, and for the next 5 years at minimum, we hope for it to go on longer, 25 and unders are free admission anytime we're open. And for 16 and under, they're free with one caregiver. And families remain free on Sundays. So we're hoping that this will really increase our attendance and accessibility at the museum.
Go. Just go.
Just go.
There's
really no reason to.
They're really making it easy for you. They really are. And they have a commodious parking as well. So that's a big
more and
deal.
More. And, right. And all kinds of offerings on the street as well.
Arvid Ashby, your book has in it my 1980s. That was a heck of a decade. That was when AIDS was in full rage. That was there were all kinds of backlash. It was not easy to be a young gay person in the 1980s. And here you are writing a book about that culture. I think you told me, and I did read, that this is not really an autobiography. It's not an autobiography. So what is it, and what was it about the 1980s? You can't help when you were born or when you're growing up. But how did that decade inform your listening and your writing?
Well, it was the decade of my adolescence into my 20s. And I mean, that's really, I think, the more I think about it, a decisive, maybe the decisive part of a person's life as far as their musical, artistic, amorous interests, as far as their hobbies, as far as their spiritual, mental makeup. I tend to think a lot of these things are carved out for a person at that point in their life. You're right. The 1980s was a crazy time. I mean, the moral majority, people screaming on TV about people going to hell, trickle-down economics, tortured hair. Just people frizzing their hair out like mad. That Farrah Fawcett poster was everywhere. God help us. Heavy metal was everywhere. Part of one basic theme of my book, My 1980s Gay Boy Playlist, is how I was really not a fan of heavy metal. I might have been the only human being in a 50-yard radius who just couldn't stand the stuff. I mean, Van Halen was everywhere and anywhere when I was in high school. And so the pieces I was involved with, the songs, the pieces were kind of an act of resistance against this a heavy metal kind of culture of the time. So
where did you grow up? Where was this happening?
Well, you mentioned that the fact that this is not an autobiography. This is not even really a memoir. It's divided into chapters, each chapter focusing on a particular piece. So in some ways, it's most basically a music book. So I don't really talk much about the where and the what of my life as such at that point. I mean, I was born and grew up in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. It's about an hour north of Milwaukee. Way out actually in the sticks. I mean, our house was surrounded by farmers' fields. County Trunk Y was this arrow straight County Trunk Road that was the nearest thoroughfare near our house. So it was really out in the boonies. But again, these details don't really come into the story. It's really about my relationship with these musical examples. And, you know, I struggled for the longest time to try and figure out what word to use for these musical examples. And as someone who's taught music history for 30 years, you know, we deal with monuments of music. We deal with, masterpieces. We deal with all of these big terms. And I finally settled on the term old musical flames. That basically in this book, I talk about eight old musical flames from the 1980s that I was heavily involved in. And I just love that term because flames, I mean, after 40 years, I'm sure we all here have flames we could talk about from our past and, you know, some abusive relationships in there, maybe some difficult relationships, some intense relationships. But, you know, there's even a beautiful old Billie Holiday song, right? My Old Flame. I can't even think of his name. So having these things that are psychic presences, even after all these decades, still kind of haunting us in good ways and maybe in bad as well.
You're somebody who is known professionally for an interest, correct me as I'm wrong, don't correct me, it's my show, for the Second Viennese School of Music, people like Webern and Alban Berg. Alban Berg is an important composer for you. He was a Viennese composer who died in 1935, was a relatively young man. He wrote music that a lot of people would consider atonal, and that's a subjective measure. But he is not a household word like Mozart or Beethoven. So how did you find, were you very young when you found Alban Berg, and was he the catalyst for a lot of other interests?
Yeah, I mean, I think I stumbled across Alban Berg, again, this is all records. Rose Records in Chicago was the main Wabash, right? Mm-hmm. On Wabash, oh my God, you wrote out the album catalog numbers on paper and you included your check and you put a blasted stamp on the envelope and you mailed it off. And then like 2 weeks later, you'd hear the sound of the UPS truck pulling up the driveway. Just, it's so funny nowadays. So you had to plan these acquaintances and these acquisitions out carefully and order them. And sometimes things went out of print. But yeah, Berg Records, I don't know how I stumbled on Berg albums in the 1970s.
So you were quite young.
Yeah, I was probably about 13, something like that. And as I detail in chapter 5 of this book, Alban Berg's lyric suite, actually the second movement from that, the Andante Amoroso, I still remember, it was the Herbert von Karajan record.
Yeah.
With the very geometric album mm-hmm. cover, very abstract.
Yeah, I know it well.
And just the sound of the Berlin Philharmonic strings, this wall-to-wall. Karajan himself once said that the sound of the Berlin string section, he said something like it was an English garden that you water and maintain for 400 years, and it just has this impenetrable lushness that is just indescribable. Mm-hmm. So I'll never forget putting the needle down, hearing this music from Berlin, and just whole, you know, planets moved and things changed and doors opened up.
I do know what you mean. I know exactly what you mean. Mine wasn't Berg, but I know exactly what you mean at similar ages. When is the book available? I know it was a labor for you, and I know you worked on it for a long time. It's being published by Punctum Books. When can we get copies?
It is an open access download, so anyone and any man, woman, child, dog, cat can download it for free starting August 11th, which is a Tuesday. It's like, what, almost 2 weeks, a little more than 2 weeks. So you just have to go to the Punctum Books, P-U-N-C-T-U-M, Punctum Books website, look up my 1980s Gay Boy playlist, and starting August 11th, you can just download it for free there. Paper copies will become available in early September. If you don't want to put more money in Jeff Bezos's pocket and want to get your copy, your print copy from somewhere else, you can go to the Punctum webpage and order from there. So yeah, it's coming out very, very soon. 6 years, as I say, of gut-wrenching work coming to an end, and I am so, so pleased that it's over.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Arvid Ashby is the writer, and Peter Stafford Wilson is the conductor, and he has a concert on July 30th with the Springfield Symphony. And violinist Joshua Bell, what other plans do you have coming up in Springfield and in Westerville, where you also conduct the orchestra?
Of course, I have to draw on my memory banks because now I'm working on 27, 28. I mean, we're always so far in advance in this business. But in Springfield, we've got a wonderful opening program in October with Norman Krieger playing the second Rachmaninoff concerto. That's going to be an all Rachmaninoff program. Oh. I'm doing the symphonic dances and also some of the Respighi settings of the Etudes Tableau. Which are very rarely played, and I love them, especially Little Red Riding Hood, you know, so scary. What else are we doing in Springfield? Celebration of America 250. We're part of the consortium that has supported Jeffrey Beagle and Peter Boyer in the creation of Rhapsody in Red, White, and Blue. So that's going to be fun. Westerville, we've got our annual Messiah sing-along coming up. And we're also doing kind of a slightly, I won't say controversial, but a very important piece. Craig Hulla Johnson's setting of remembering Matthew, considering
you're really
Matthew.
Doing that. That's a heart-wrenching, beautiful work.
A work that remembers Matthew Shepard, but also is a real defiance of hate, which is so, I think, important to today's society. I mean, I serve the orchestra in Springfield, Ohio, and we don't have to mention the political
ramifications. We'll talk a little bit about it. How is the situation in Springfield where you have a large Haitian community and they are living under all kinds of threat and all kinds of difficulty, shall we say?
Right.
Rightly or wrongly, and now, how is that impacting your work?
Any community of 40 to 50,000 people that all of a sudden has 10,000 people who kind of arrive, there are very positive things because they're mechanics, they're healthcare workers, they're engineers, they're people who are working in the
restaurants,
industry.
Restaurants, wonderful restaurants.
Yes. So there's a lot of positive impact on, presence on the tax roll and support of the economy, and Springfield is enjoying a resurgence, I think, in part thanks to that. But there also are people who have lived there for many years going, wait a minute, what about us? How can we benefit, as you catch up with the demands on the infrastructure? There's been a lot of rabble-rousing from outside.
Not from the community. The TV cameras are there thinking that these are the people who live there, and that may
not
be.
That is not always the case. I, in fact, sat in the hotel and watched a U-Haul truck pull up, a box truck, and out of the back piled 12 neo-Nazis ready to march and demonstrate and so forth. So it's been very difficult. The impact on the arts simply is our care for security and making sure that our patrons and our artists are all safe. But we do keep an eye on the situation and our finger on the pulse.
Joshua Bell would not come to Springfield if he didn't feel he could perform as he wants to perform. And
exactly.
Here he is.
And he's actually being very generous. He wants two rehearsals and unlike Mr. Perlman, who came in, played through the Beethoven, said, yep, I recognized it, and then left,
So. And they did love him. This is All Sides Weekend. I'm Christopher Purdy. We're going to take one more break and come back with more Don't Go Away. We are back. This is All Sides Weekend. I'm Christopher Purdy talking with Arvid Ashby, who is Professor Emeritus of Music at The Ohio State University. His new book is My 1980s Gay Boy Playlist. Peter Stafford Wilson, among others, is the music director of the Springfield Symphony. July 30th, next Thursday night in Springfield. What time?
7:30.
The Springfield Symphony performs with violinist Joshua Bell, and Brooke Minto is the CEO of the Columbus Museum of Art, which now, by the way, in case you didn't know, has two campuses.
Yes, we do, and it's really exciting. We relaunched CMA at the Pizzuti last summer, and actually, as you were speaking just now, I was thinking about this wonderful exhibition that sort of ties the two campuses together.
It's in the Short North, right?
Yeah, it's in the Short North on Park, right across from Dale. And we have this wonderful show, Tavara Strom, The Day Tomorrow Began, that's featured at CMA at the Pizzuti. But one of the major works from that show, called In Praise of Midnight, Christophe and Napoleon, is this massive, nearly 20-foot tall monumental sculpture that is in the atrium on Broad Street. So even though the majority of the show is at Samantha Pizzuti, there's this wonderful sculpture of the Haitian revolutionary Henri Christophe that's at Broad Street, and we're hoping that'll encourage everyone to go to our second campus and see the fullness of the show.
The second campus, it was the Pizzuti collection, I believe, which he turned over to the Columbus Museum of Art. How is that campus location different from Broad Street?
It's very different. So as you know, Ron Pizzuti was at one time the president of the Art Museum's board. He's a longtime collector, and he ran it as a collection space up to 2018 and then gifted it to the museum. So it's been ours for some years now. And when I arrived in 23, we spent some time really rethinking what the best use of this space could be and how it could really extend the museum's program. We obviously have this wonderful addition to the museum that's now 10 years old, so we have quite a lot of gallery space. So we knew that this additional building in the Short North had to do something extra for us. And what we do there is longer-term exhibition installations. They're very immersive. So we invite in living artists to kind of take over the space and plan for this kind of all-over exhibitions that really, change the way you experience art. You come into this exhibition, The Day Tomorrow Began, and you're experiencing art with all of your senses. You're seeing these wonderful installations that are sculpture, painting, but there's also multi-sensory experience. There's music, there's scent, and then there's also a culinary component to it.
That's the Pizzuti collection that's on Park in the Short North.
Yeah, we now call it CMA at the Pizzuti.
CMA at the Pizzuti.
Yeah.
And are the hours, does the under 25 go for that as well?
It doesn't yet, but
okay.
We do have a lot of free programming. So after hours really come alive in the summer and year round. So we do a program called Night Shift at the Pizzuti, and admission is free during Night Shift Fridays, Friday evenings. And that's due to a grant from the Franklin County community grant that underwrites that programming. So there's definitely opportunities for free admission, but admission there is pretty accessible at $10 and always free for members.
Okay.
Yeah.
I will say again, the museum has always had the reputation of making it as easy as possible for people to get into the building, and including parking, at least on Broad Street, where it's at a premium. You have all kinds of great parking. Lovely restaurant, too, by the way.
Chaco Cafe.
Yes.
Yeah, we're very fortunate. We have a wonderful chef, and it's got its regulars. It's a nice place to meet.
That's with the Columbus Museum of Art. Brooke Minto is the CEO. And I am delighted that you're here as we're starting to wind up the conversation, but I want to make sure everybody gets last words in. Arvid Ashby, I want to ask you about the title of your book, My 1980s Gay Boy Playlist. Talk about the title a little bit.
The title is purposefully, how to put it, maybe a little bit in your face. I mentioned it in an email when I was still teaching at OSU. I mentioned it in an email, the title of the book, to a colleague in the School of Music, and they thought I was joking and replied with a tears of laughter emoji. But that's all to a point, because when I was writing this Mahler book, I confronted this, for me, very big question about how to talk about music and history and culture for a general readership, not for other academics, not for musicologists.
I want to ask you about that. Go ahead.
And it's interesting that one major point of inspiration here was going to the museum and seeing these, what are they called, decals, the descriptions of the art.
Wall labels.
Wall labels.
Mm-hmm.
And just seeing the sheer mastery of the people who write these plain-spoken, penetrating, cogent discussions, introductions to these works on the wall. I mean, I learned so much just by reading these labels at the museum. So I said, how can I do this kind of label writing with music? So it was a huge thing, and I wrote the Mahler book with this kind of label approach. No jargon, no dryas, no big words. Strunk and White. Use small words, use few words. And it was really transformative, to the point where now, honestly, academic writing just, it actually makes me physically ill practically when I try to read it and I don't try to read it. So wanting to be incredibly honest, wanting to come down from this kind of idea of academic authority and the author puffing themselves up and sort of being objective and being an authority on the subject. I wanted to do the exact opposite. I wanted to be incredibly honest and intimate with the reader. And I think intimacy, certainly after the pandemic, I have just this, personally, this crazy need for intimacy. Conversation, sitting down for coffee or drinks with people, connecting in a way that I think people have kind of lost over the pandemic. And it's really kind of a painful situation. So writing books that are intimate, that are honest, very forthright for a general readership, certain degrees of creativity to be interesting and provocative and detailed, that's really, I think, where this book and the title are coming from.
You allowed me to read the book about a year or so ago when it was still formative, I think before you came up with your final version. And what I told you was the mark of a successful book like this for me was that it brought me to the music, particularly some of the music you referenced that I didn't know well or was not part of my rig. And I'm on the air, if y'all don't know, on 89.7, I'm the morning host on Classical 101, so I'm there. That's my day job, as it were. So I'm supposed to know, but there were a lot of people, like the Baird Lyric Suite. I haven't sat with that for a long time. Kurt Cobain is not well known to me.
Yeah,
I'm
was going
to
say,
few people in the world.
How is your Kurt Cobain
album?
Not
great, not great. It needs to be better, but you got me started. But it did bring me to the music, which a dry academic book would not. It would have me running for the aspirin. This book did not do that. It had me going for recordings of music.
And I really wanted it to read like, well, for want of a better word, literature. I took New Yorker magazine style prose as my model. I wanted to write, well, a page turner of sorts. I wanted someone to start reading it and just say, oh, this is crazy. This is interesting. This is, where is this going? And keep turning pages, which, to put it mildly, is not something that usually happens with academic books.
So we're not going to call this an academic book because it's not.
No, it is a rejection of academic
books. Well, why did your colleague send you that weepy emoji when you gave him the title?
Well, I think it was the word gay boy. I mean, it's what? It's pejorative. It's flinchy. It's just not something that one, certainly an academic, a professor of music, doesn't sort of apply to themselves, right? Instead, we're supposed to, I don't know, be fond of our titles and our degrees and all of this kind of authority stuff. But again, I wanted to put myself in a certain place just right before you even open the book up. I wanted to not equalize, but show
you wanted
the degree
to make
of honesty.
Friends. That's what you wanted. Yeah.
I wanted to say, this is who I am. We live in a time just, you know, the meanness nowadays. Some days I just feel like I'm neck deep in lies and meanness around in the world. And this was an attempt to come up for air.
Well, you did it. And I congratulate you again on your book. New from Punctum Press, my 1980s Gay Boy playlist. We'll be hearing more about this book. I think you have some events in work. You're working on some events locally to promote the book that we will talk about that as dates are firmed up. But Peter Wilson, I want to, before we go, I want to sell some more tickets here. Let's go. July 30th, next Thursday night in Springfield with violinist Joshua Bell. If people aren't sure, just give me a real rundown on who is Joshua Bell.
Well, Joshua Bell is sort of the Itzhak Perlman of the next generation. And he's got a lot of popular culture notoriety. He was the soloist in The Red Violin, the 1998 Samuel L. Jackson film. He also was made famous as being the busker in the subway, playing unaccompanied Bach with his case open. And the sad commentary was all the people that walked right past him.
Yeah.
Which...
He did that after his fame. He was experimenting with him. Would anybody notice him? Right, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So
these are some of the people who spent $50 to see him perform, but walked by him on the subway when he
right.
was,
when
free.
He was
right.
doing it for yeah. free. Yeah. So an incredible talent. I'm a little bit nervous because he's notorious for being rough on conductors, but... You know,
put up your dukes, dude.
Friday morning always did.
You got him. Listen, you got him, and he's playing. How long will he be with you? Just the day?
A couple days. He's coming in Wednesday night, I think, to rehearse because he is sort of warming up for the BSO, and I get it. So, but we're the beneficiary because we really get to drill down in the piece, which is not always the option.
And it is not an arduous commute between Columbus and Springfield. It's 45 minutes.
Right.
It's a gorgeous hall. It's a very fine orchestra. If you don't know, let's not keep it a secret. They're out there. They've been in business for 70 years, which means they're doing something right. Because when performing arts entities are closing down and going, you know, and there you are. You're there 25 years. You're
25.
Going
25
years as music director and still going. You are also music director of the Westerville Symphony. You play at Otterbein, is that correct?
Right, that's correct. Long relationship with Otterbein University.
You have good crowds for Otterbein. You have very good crowds at Otterbein.
Very supportive audience in that area.
Okay, you also run two ballet companies.
Well, I don't run them.
Well, you're the music conductor in Tulsa and in Kansas City. How do you conduct for ballet? I don't know why it strikes me as really hard.
Well, you intrigue me with that question. You know, people ask me the difference between symphonic and ballet, and I say, well, symphonic conducting, I'm in charge. Mm-hmm. And ballet conducting, everybody else is in charge. You know, my real master is the tempo. What tempo can I lay down to make the dancer look good? And that we discover through rehearsal. But it is very much a collaborative thing. And
so you have to work really closely with a choreographer.
Exactly.
Like in opera, the director and the conductor usually hate each other and they don't have anything to do with each other.
We don't have that option here.
That luxury of doing that.
Well, and one thing that your listeners will be interested in, my book of business this year is incredibly robust. I'm doing a Swan Lake in Tulsa, and then the two Prokofiev major ballets, Cinderella and Romeo and Juliet, the setting by Eddie Liang, who used to lead Ballet Met here in Columbus.
Course.
So I can't wait to see Eddie.
Edward has had a time of it because he was in residence at the Kennedy Center for a while with the Washington Ballet.
It's been a tough time, that's become
a nomadic existence for him as well. Why has the Springfield Symphony lasted for 70 years?
Well, I think partially it's because of deep roots in that community. People love the orchestra. For the longest time, Wittenberg University had a very strong music department, and we grew from that where our personnel were concerned. But and also a large cachet of very forward-thinking business people back in the 60s who said, you know, tough times are coming for the arts. Let's get together and raise the money to endow this orchestra. And the endowment for the orchestra, you have to jump two levels in our peer groups to see an orchestra that is as endowed as we are. So it's a combination of a lot of things.
Well, congratulations to Springfield that needs good news and has it. Thank you very much for that. And Brooke Minto, again, if you're under 25, you get in free to the Columbus Museum of Art. If you're under 16 with your caregiver, your parent or somebody, you get in free as well. You have two campuses, the beautiful building on Broad Street and the beautiful building in the Short North.
Equally gorgeous,
which was the Pizzuti Collection. And closing thoughts, anything just except come.
Well, come and also save the date for our fall exhibitions. We have new shows opening in September and October that we're really excited about. A wonderful show at Broad Street called Claire Rojas Returning that features a wonderful painter, sculptor, musician who's originally from Columbus, who's made the majority of her career in the San Francisco Bay Area, but returned to Columbus, and it will be her first solo show here in her hometown. And then another wonderful show celebrating an incredible philanthropic gift, a show called Queer Constellations, and it's photographs from the Aronowitz Family Collection, many of which will become part of the permanent collection this year. So celebrating that gift.
Bottom line, go to the museum. Get your bottom into the museum and go to the Museum of Art.
Yes.
Get yourself to Springfield July 30th and throughout the season for Peter Stafford Wilson and the Springfield Symphony, and get yourself a copy of my 1980s Gay Boy playlist written by Arvid Ashby. And that is this edition of All Sides Weekend on 89.7 NPR News. My thanks to Chris Johnston, who makes radio out there and does all the work. Thank you, Chris. Thank you all for listening. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend on 89.7 NPR News.
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.